Please mind the gap between the train and the platform.
This is Barbican Station. Hello and welcome back to Barbican Station. I'm your host, Jeff. This episode, we'll be talking about Mick Herron's latest, Clown Town. I'm pleased to welcome Sam Leith to the show. Sam is literary editor at The Spectator and host of their book club podcast. Sam has also written several books, including Words Like Loaded Pistols, Rhetoric from Aristotle to Obama, and his most recent, The Haunted Wood, A History of Childhood Reading. Sam, thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So we're going to get to Clown Town, but I want to talk about a couple of your other books and other things because I think they dovetail a bit with Herron. But even before that, I have to ask, you got a weekly podcast. How many books do you read a year? Like, seriously, what is that?
I mean, I don't know. It's probably 60 or 70 books a year. It was more when I was researching my book, but it's basically a book a week for the podcast. I talk to an author about a new or recent book. Sometimes we talk to people about big writers who just died or you know, reissues of interesting classics or anniversaries, things like that. But it's normally a book or two a week, and I review and do my own writing on top of that. So it varies. But yeah, I heard, I think, recently from somebody who works at Waterstones that somebody who buys 6 books a year is considered a heavy user. So I suppose I'm an extremely heavy user by that standard. I'm slightly depressed by that discovery. Those of us who track our Amazon rankings are like, oh God, 6 books a year, you know, doesn't seem to leave a lot of people buying books, you know.
But yeah, I know. It's crazy.
A lot of people buy mixed books, though, which is nice.
Yes. For anyone interested in language and how it's used, Words Like Loaded Pistols is just a great read. I really enjoyed it. And you talk through rhetoric and how it's like it's a set of tools that everybody uses, whether they know it or not.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I have to ask, has the U.S. killed, like, thoughtful rhetoric? You know, you talk about the pillars of rhetoric, which are ethos, which is trust, logos, logic, and pathos, emotion. Have we just turned the knob on pathos so far?
Well, yeah.
There's no going back.
I don't think we can blame this, much as I'd love to, on the U.S. Get rid of that guilt. I think what's happened is that the, you know, Marshall McLuhan was right that the medium is the message. And I think historically, as the technologies by which persuasive speech propagates have changed, so the way in which, you know, it works changes. And I think the age of radio changed the way rhetoric was done, the way social media, you know, I mean, like the Aboriginal form of rhetoric is, you know, you could say the Greek agora. It's people speaking to people exactly in earshot. And these speeches weren't written down, they weren't promulgated, you didn't have, as it were, overhearers. And, you know, we've been talking for 40 or 50 years about soundbite culture and about the idea that soundbites are more important than full speeches. And that's to do with the way that things are transmitted, the way that the news cycle works, the way that, you know, I mean, Cicero had soundbites, but Cicero didn't have like 24-hour rolling news or Twitter to make his soundbites as out of proportion important. And I think what's happened is that in our digital age, we've got a series of sort of algorithmic tools, which are how persuasive language, particularly politically persuasive language, kind of propagates through the culture. And those tools favor things that are short, you know, in which lengthy arguments tend not to be promulgated, and things that are highly emotive, because that's what gets you the likes and clicks and retweets and shares and so forth. So, yeah, I think certainly the sort of elaborately developed arguments that we like to imagine existed in some golden age of rhetoric are harder to find. But also it swings a bit like a pendulum. I mean, it seemed to me that Obama, who was the kind of starting point for the book I wrote way back when, I mean, this was like 2011, I think, Obama had just, you know, come to power. And I saw a kind of pendulum there where, you know, George W. Bush had come before and was, by certain standards, kind of seen as inarticulate. You know, he had a kind of Honest Joe, Forrest Gumpy kind of quality, which is a rhetorical strategy. You know, if you're not a sophisticated speaker, your audience will tend to think, well, he can't form a sentence himself. He's certainly not sophisticated enough to pull the wool over our eyes, so we can kind of trust him. And then you got Obama, who was this extremely articulate kind of classical orator. You know, people kind of got fed up with George Bush, and so the pendulum swung back towards, you know, a very articulate speaker who used rhetorical tools very consciously. And then, you know, it swings back in the opposite direction and we get the guy now who has enormous rhetorical force, but it's not of that sort of elaborate, well worked out, developing an argument using florid language way. It's much more visceral and much more disconnected and less articulate than that itself, and more emotive. And that itself, I think, has a particular strength when the main vector is, you know, social media, culture wars stuff.
So then where does that sit in the UK? Because Heron does these really amazing kind of pen portraits of politicians in his books. Do you see him like pulling some of the rhetoric from the politicians to put in there? Do you think he is accurate on those pen portraits and what he's doing?
I think so. I mean, I think he's not really interested in a kind of thoroughgoing analysis of those politicians. They're kind of vibes and set dressing, I think. I mean, like, in a sense, I think what Heron is doing is going like, what about the world as it is pissing me off? And he looks at someone like Boris Johnson and he pours, you know, many of the qualities he sees in Boris into Peter Judd. And likewise, you know, Keir Starmer in Clown Town gets a kind of walk on. I don't think he's named, but it's very clearly Keir Starmer. And because Mick, and I think it's one of the things that makes these novels so rich, because he's a really seriously good and sensitive reader of language, he captures the voices. You know, he's really big on voice. And, you know, I think one of the things that writers like Mick Heron, that puts them head and shoulders above other genre writers, is that in order to write a competent spy novel, you don't really need to be able to write. You know, you just need to be able to hit plot beats and get the pacing right and, you know, make it twisty, make it intriguing, keep the reader going. But if you can do that and have the sort of rich characterization, the linguistic fizz that you get in Mick Heron, and I'd say that you get in a very different way in someone like Lee Child, who's another kind of colossal striding genre writer, and in, you know, Stephen King with his ear for main idiolect, you're really doing something more interesting. And so, like, you know, Jackson Lamb is kind of a voice. He's a series of jokes. He's a series of, you know, one-liners and responses. And Roddy Ho's interior monologue, again, is very linguistically sensitive. You know, it's how does Roddy speak? How does Roddy think? It's all there. And it's really funny. And that's what I think why, for instance, Roddy doesn't work on screen half so well as he works in these books, because Roddy's interiority and the gap between the dramatic irony between how Roddy sees the world and how everyone else sees the world. You know, Roddy sees a hummingbird, everyone else sees a platypus. These qualities are what makes these books so, so great. And I think that, you know, he applies that to the politicians as well. You know, he just goes like, okay, what's the pompous way Judd would speak, or the sort of wheedling way Judd would speak? You know, what's the sort of droning, bureaucratic way Keir Starmer would speak? And, you know, he just kind of watercolor washes each of those characters with a particular idiolect, which means, yeah, he's picking up on their rhetorical style. But I don't see these books. I mean, I've read some people saying these are kind of state of the nation novels disguised as spy thrillers. I kind of think it's the other way around. I think they're definitely spy thrillers, but with a kind of lick of state of the nation satire thrown in.
Your most recent book is The Haunted Wood, and Mick Heron has many times talked about one of his favorite books is The Wind in the Willows. And I wanted to read to you something he wrote for the UK org Give a Book. He says, "A book I've been carrying in my mind for what feels like my whole life is The Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham. It's a book about talking animals, of course, and as such might easily be thought of as being for children only. But a recent rereading reminded me that behind all the fun and fantastic adventures, it's also a book about friendship, and about making mistakes and being given second chances, and about getting lost and being found again. Most of all, though, it's a book about home and how it's possible to make a home anywhere, whether in a mansion, a caravan, a boat, a prison cell, or even on the open road. It's also very funny and finishes, as many good books do, with a great big fight. Something, in fact, for everyone." So as the children's literature expert, does his esteem for Wind in the Willows give you any kind of special insight into his work here?
Well, do you know, I didn't know that I didn't see that piece or that interview. That's kind of fascinating. I mean, The Wind in the Willows it's a really odd book. You know, it's got these two extraordinarily strange and trippy chapters in which the characters, it is a book about home. I mean, my analysis of The Wind in the Willows is that it's a book that's sort of about this tension all the way through between the conservative instincts, between home, between the kind of safety of the riverbank, and a kind of anxious wanderlust, which takes you out into something deeper and darker and stranger, which I guess that kind of shuttling is sort of present in Heron. You know, you've got the sense that, like, all of these books are really expressly rooted in Slough House, you know, the place you kind of can't escape, but it's a physical presence, and it's a kind of, that building is the heart of the stories, and the characters are kind of faring out from the building, and, you know, terrible things happen, and then they, you know, all the pieces sort of return to the chessboard. Some of them, well, most of the pieces return to the chessboard at the end of any given installment. But yeah, I mean, I think the sort of sunny qualities of The Wind in the Willows are not present in Mick's work. You know, The Wind in the Willows, like, Kenneth Graham was a deeply, deeply troubled and unhappy man. He never really was at home in adult life. And, you know, one of the points, I mean, Mick didn't make about The Wind in the Willows is that, with the exception of the washerwoman whose headscarf, I think, Toad steals when he escapes from jail, it's a book that has no women in it. Kenneth Graham was, like, very express, you know, it's free of the troubles of sex and romance and dealing with women. It's you know, these sort of childlike characters live in an intensely homosocial, conservative, safe little bubble. And I don't think really you could accuse Mick Herron of creating such a thing in his own. But yeah, ending with a fight. Yeah, absolutely. And I think also in the sense that The Wind in the Willows, like Herron's work, there's a lot more going on in it than it's, you know, sort of, as it were, headline of being a children's story would let you know. And for those who don't care to see it, you won't notice that, for example, Toad's story is, like, expressly patterned on the shape of the Odyssey. And likewise, Mick's doing with his books, you know, there's all sorts of sort of metafictional goings on. I mean, I think I was very struck, I think, when I was reading Clown Town, by the kind of slightly Dickensian quality he sometimes has. You know, Dickens being a great storyteller, but he'll give you, particularly in those kind of big drop intros where he sort of walks you round Slough House, these wonderfully sort of Baroque kind of Dickensian senses about the setup. And so, you know, Mick Herron is a profoundly well-read writer who is very happy to just leave these inferences and these allusions available for people who choose to pick them up. But you can just read it as a spy thriller as well.
And I was going to say, yeah, good news. It sounds like Heron's life and upbringing much less weird than Kenneth Graham.
Oh, yeah. No, as far as I know from my, you know, handful of encounters with him in the flesh, you know, he's like a well-adjusted and happy dude. And as far as I know, his marriage is much better than that of Kenneth Graham.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about your overall feelings about the Slough House series, because you've written quite a bit about it, hosted discussions, you just mentioned meeting Heron. How did you first encounter the series?
Now I'm trying to remember. The series was rediscovered by, as I'm sure your listeners will by now know, commissioning editor then at John Murray called Mark Richards, who I know a bit. And I think Mark had mentioned to me, you know, these books are great, I'm republishing them. And I can't remember whether it's him or possibly my dad who found them and got into them. But at the stage when they were a well-kept secret, i.e. the second and third, I think, had just been republished in the UK. As you'll remember, they were published to no fanfare at all in the UK and kind of withered on the vine. And then they were published in the States. And then Mark picked a copy of one of the US editions up at an airport, read it, went, this is amazing. I've got to republish these and make them work in the UK. And God bless him, he did. So it was when we were around about book two or three, I think, in the UK, I cottoned on and started reading them and pressing them on my friends and doing what everyone who discovered them at that stage did. And they were in the kind of well-kept secret territory. And I can't remember, again, the sequence of events, but at some point, I think, when they were edging from well-kept secret to everyone in the book world knows about them and is pressing them on their friends, I asked Mick to come and do a Spectator podcast with me for the publication of one of them. And I can't remember because I don't want to, I certainly wouldn't begin to sort of say I'd take credit. I spotted him, and, you know, I very much didn't. He was moving out from well-kept secret even then, but he wasn't yet the outright mega poop he now is. And I just kind of followed them since then. I, you know, when one came out, if I was offered an opportunity to review one, I grabbed it with both hands, and the pages that I control in the Spectator magazine, I gleefully made sure that we got a review in. And that's sort of been the way ever since. And every Christmas we now have ritual that I ask him whether he'd be kind enough to write us a Christmas short story for the Spectator. And every Christmas he very politely declines. It's become slightly more absurd as the Christmases go on and the kind of Apple TV series proliferate. My feelings about any sort of, as it were, genre writer I discover who's producing a series that's consistently great and that's firing on all cylinders, that's not just exciting, but is really beautifully written and really clever and really engaging. Because there aren't all that many of them around. And, you know, when you find one, you kind of fall on it. You know, and I don't know, in SF, you could say something like Jeff Vandermeer or... I mean, yes, ones are normally kind of ones off, I think. But, you know, in thrillers, people like Lee Child, I mean, in spy writing, obviously there's Le Carré, Len Dayton going further back. I like Joseph Cannon. You know, there's always a handful of people in genres who are going, like, screw you, literary fiction, I can do this better than any of you. And, you know, he's one of them. I mean, my feelings about them, I think, as the series has gone on, have shifted ever so slightly in as much as I used to sort of think of them as things you could just pick up book two or three and get stuck in and you wouldn't miss that much. I think they've become very slightly less self-contained. I mean, anyone who writes a series has a bit of a decision to make about how much you can read them as standalones. And I think, for instance, a crime writer I loved, Robert B. Parker, his Spencer novels, of which, you know, he wrote about three or four a year, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of them. And they all kind of work as standalones. I mean, you know, there is a sort of history to them and you know about the relationship between Spencer and his best friend, Hawk, and his girlfriend. And there are a couple of villains who reappear. But fundamentally, you could pick up any Spencer novel and within 50 pages, you kind of know where you are. And I think the same was true of Slough House for the first couple of books. I think now, if I were pressing them on a friend, I'd say, like, start at the beginning and read through. Because the carryover from novel to novel has become, I may be getting this wrong, but this is my impression, has become stronger and a bit more complex. Clown Town has a payoff or a kind of climactic event, which essentially pays off five or six books worth of manoeuvring by the aforementioned Peter Judd, and which depends very heavily on things that have happened in previous books. And, you know, like River wakes up with Novichok poisoning in this book, and though he, you know, says how it's happened, in a kind of alludes to the previous books, yeah, how that came about, and, you know, Sid's got a bullet in the head and so forth, but you're kind of going to be a little bit at sea, I think, if you start with this book. In fact, it's a kind of, here's a sort of instance of that which I've been kind of ruminating on ever since, which is the previous book. I chaired a bookshop event with Mick, and he gave this sort of introduction in which he said, he made some slightly kind of dry joke about being chaired by clueless people, which obviously, you know, made me sort of rather anxious. And then I asked him the first question. And my first question was alluding to the fact that at the beginning of that book, I think it was the previous book, we think River's dead. So in a sense, it was a spoiler for the book before. But, you know, it was clear from page one that, you know, River isn't on the scene. And I said, you know, like, you start the book with River off the board. What? See, this is just what I was talking about, you know, spoilers. So I was, oh God. And so then it was really awkward because I thought he was actually being dry and funny, because I wrote to him immediately afterwards to apologize and said, like, Christ, I'm sorry. I didn't think it counted as a spoiler, because I thought literally everybody in that room is here because they read the previous book and they want to know what happens next. And he said, no. I was going to say that, whatever you said. It was part of my shtick. You know, it was a joke. But there was that question of, like, okay, do spoilers apply? I tend to assume that anyone who comes to these books, you know, comes to the new book by this stage, 90% of the people who pick up Clown Town will be picking it up because they've read the previous book. And that, therefore, certainly, you don't need to worry about spoiling page one.
Yeah. I mean, what I would say is, it seems like, could you pick it up and read it on its own? Sure, but all of the character stuff that's been built up over the past several books, it's just, you're going to miss it and it won't hit as hard as I think it does at the end.
And one of the things about this book, and it does take us a bit further, is, you know, all the way through this series, you're like, what's Jackson's, you know, what's his thing? What's his moral center? Because obviously he plays at being deeply amoral and Machiavellian, and everything's sort of in some sense a sale. But he's also got this, you know, you look after your Joes. The extent to which the angles he's working are worked around an irreducible moral core is a kind of question mark that runs throughout, I think, the series, and that remains interesting. There's a line I was flicking back through the book. Somebody says at some point to Diana Tablet, is he doing what he feels he has to do, or is he doing what he feels is expected of him to do? Is his kind of honor, you know, is it a mere scutcheon, or is it something that's coming from within him? You know, is it extrinsic or intrinsic? And that's a kind of open question in the books. And I think there's this climactic confrontation in which Lamb is sort of, as it were, taken to the top of the hill and looked down. All this could be yours, like the devil tempted Jesus in the wilderness. And you know, he's quite Cromwellian. There's this, like, you've been a spy for years, says Judge. You know, is it time you got some recognition? And he's like, no, I'm a spy. Recognition is kind of the opposite of what I'm looking for. You know, it's gone wrong if you get recognition. You know, the extent to which Lamb is a saint and the extent to which he isn't, you know, I think all the way through these books, Mick is rather brilliantly riding two horses, one arse on that question.
So, you know, you talked about genre writers that can kind of elevate themselves out of the genre a little bit, right? And so what is it you think about Heron in particular that does that? And my own theory is that it has something to do with him starting out as a poet. And you see that throughout his writing. I mean, he uses a ton of similes, and that way of description is such a something that's kind of, I would imagine, ingrained in a lot of poets. I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Yeah, it's an ear. You know, every poet needs an ear to be able to hear the cadences of how words work together, of how a sentence falls to the reader. And poets are especially sensitively attuned to sound effects, and so is Mick Heron. But fundamentally, it's just about being able to effing write. You know, you can be able to produce very serviceable genre fiction and be a terrible writer of sentences. I mean, the paramount example of this, of course, is Dan Brown. Now, like, I read and reviewed Dan Brown's last book, and, you know, it's the man cannot string together a sentence. And yet it works, because it's sort of, he's incredibly long in other suits, but it makes you wince, stroke, laugh all the way through. And again, Harlan Coben, I think, is a terrible writer of sentences. I think he's a great writer of plots. And Harlan Coben's novels deservedly sell zillions of copies. I think someone who can do both is, you know, a jeweled past price. And I should say, incidentally, that I think literary fiction, so-called literary fiction, where the emphasis is on the writing, is full of people who also can't write. And that's why bad literary fiction is much worse than, you know, bad genre fiction. But yeah, he can really write. He's got an eye for a metaphor. He's got an ear for the way a sentence lands. And he's just having fun with language. And so much of what makes these books, you know, once you've got the bones of the plot, and he's good at the bones of the plot, generally, he's good at pacing, you're kind of interested in what happens next, which is the kind of bar for entry in this type of book. Once you've got the bones of the plot on there, he fleshes them out with this absolute line-by-line fizz. It's in the dialogue. It's in the way that the different characters have different ways of speaking. You know, they've all got a different idiom, and though their different idioms kind of bounce off each other, there's a lot of wordplay, a lot of back and forth dialogue, you know, a lot of, which is a poet's vice, puns. You know, like, he's got into the last couple of books, he's got into a running joke. He may have his foot on the pedal a bit too much with this one, I think, of Jackson Lamb says something wrong. Yeah, he says the wrong word. And someone else says, I think you mean right word. And he then goes, no, because, I mean, I think there's a line in this where he says, that's a bit of a sword of Dominic Cummings. And he said, don't you mean Sword of Damocles? And he said, no, conniving arsehole who's got too big for his boots or something. You know, he's like, you know, no, I meant what I said. And that's, you know, those puns, which he has an indecent amount of fun with. You know, puns are a very distinctively poet's vice. So I think it's all that stuff. I mean, one of the ways I think about the books is that they exist in more than one genre at once. yes, they're absolutely spy novels. Each individual book is shaped like a spy thriller. You know, there's a normally dramatic ending. It's like a dramatic bit of violence or a mysterious assassination or whatever the hell. There's some bang at the beginning that drags you in. Then there's two or three different threads that are being pulled on and different angles being worked, and they all sort of tie up more or less neatly in a climactic ending, and secrets are uncovered and explained, and more secrets are buried, and, you know, the pieces, as I say, return to the beginning of the chessboard. But that, in terms of the kind of vibe, page by page, scene by scene, there's something a bit more like a sitcom. You know, this is a sort of office comedy, as much as it's also a spy thriller. You know, it's about people sitting in Slough House doing makeshift jobs, and Jackson Lamb at no point encases anyone's stapler in jelly, as they do in The Office. But, you know, kind of, you might as well. That's the, you know, there's that aspect to the palette of it. But again, a sitcom has the qualities of a strip cartoon in that, to return to my chessboard metaphor, you know, all the pieces go back to the, like an episode of Friends or an episode of All in the Family or an episode of The Cosby Show. The characters always begin the episode. They're the same characters. Their relationships are the same. The familiarity and, you know, the cast of characters basically remains the same. And they have some adventures and the episode is self-contained and then you go back. Whereas in this, it's not quite like that because, as previously discussed, it's a longer running kind of, you know, now the genre, roman fleuve, in which things are developing. And, you know, Le Carré does this, Len Dayton does this. Each of the books is its own story, but those stories build up to larger arcs, which is why it works so brilliantly as, you know, a series of Apple TV series. There are larger arcs, there are bigger movements, and, you know, he kills off the characters with quite some enthusiasm. You don't always know who's going to be alive at the beginning of the next one. And, you know, sometimes you go, oh, look, it's a new recruit. And then you're like, bang, oh, well, you know, nice to meet them. Goodbye, oh. So there's all that stuff going on at once, which I think it's a very good selling point. Each one's really fun. Each one's really funny. And each one in some way kind of develops. And of course, develops a larger plot. So you want to keep reading the next one to find out what the loose threads in the last one are going to turn into. And it's got that political satire aspect of it as well, that fact that he likes to keep it up to date with contemporary events. I mean, as witness, Pitchfork, who's the kind of main plot in this one, which is a kind of IRA informant who was a double agent who was being run by the security services back in the 70s, is a Heron Funhouse mirror version of a real thing that happened, the steak knife thing, which came out, I think, in the early 2000s, that there'd been a particularly vicious, murderous IRA guy who had been a British intelligence asset all along. And the intelligence services basically kept him out of trouble, despite the fact he was going around murdering people, in order to preserve his line of intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, that whole thing was very Law and Order ripped from the headlines kind of feel to it there.
Yeah. And he's done that a couple. Yeah, I mean, there's a Novichok plotline, which is again ripped from the headlines.
Yep. So that's perfect segue. Let's get into Clown Town, because you reviewed that for, I believe, The Guardian, and I think it was a positive review.
It was. I should say, if you've got time, there is a kind of funny story attached to that, which I reviewed it for The Guardian with great pleasure and admiration, as I've reviewed all of his work. But I said, like, my kids are now in their, you know, early and mid-teens. But like 10 years ago, when they were tiny, I used to take them to these soft play centers. I don't know whether the word is the same in the States, but it's one of those places where you've got a toddler, you're desperate to fill time with the toddler, and you take them and you sort of dump them into this big apparatus, and you can sit and have a cup of coffee while they climb up things and down things and bash each other in the face and, you know, do all the stuff that kids, toddlers do in, you know, ball pits and slides and little climbing nets and things. And there was this soft play centre I occasionally found myself at on the North Circular Road in London called Clown Town. And so I did this big drop intro in which I played up, as any parent who's ever been to a soft play centre and felt the will to live draining out through the soles of their shoes, a big drop intro saying, you know, is it an accident? And of course it was an accident. The Mick Herron's new novel shares its name with this particularly bleak soft play centre on the North Circular Road. And I kind of imagined this soft play centre as much more horrible than it actually is. But, you know, soft play centers are not a fun place for parents normally. And so I did this big drop intro about, you know, parents sitting there kind of staring glumly into space and waiting for death, and the children all stabbing each other with forks and so forth. Huge comic exaggeration. To be honest, if Mick's new book had been called Little Dinosaurs, that is the soft play center I would have lit on to complain about. Anyway, I thought nothing of this. And I made the point that that the novels are kind of knockabout, and that they've got a sort of soft play energy to them, you know, this unconstrained chaos. Anyway, this was really just a kind of over elaborate joke that took out the first two paragraphs of my review. But about a week and a half after my review appeared, weirdly enough, my mother got an email from the man who owns the Soft Play Center, and he was extremely aggrieved and felt that I'd libeled him, and went as far as to send a starchy lawyer's letter to The Guardian. I did apologize fulsomely and say, look, you know, this was all comic exaggeration. And I think that the you know, actual legal action has yet to appear, but I very much hope that he feels appeased, you know. And if he's listening now, I should say I absolutely meant no offense, and your soft play center is a delightful place to hang out with children, in as much as any soft play centers are.
That's great. So, you know, Clown Town, full spoilers ahead here. I, you know, cards on the table for me. I think, interestingly, my first time reading it through, I wasn't as big of a fan, I think, of this one. And I reread it before we talked, and I actually enjoyed it a lot more on my second read. And I was trying to figure out what exactly my issue had been. Some of it, I think, is this book in particular takes place over a very short time frame, right? It's only a couple of days, like in real time, as far as it goes. And I ended up reading it over a longer period, and it was a little shorter chunks. And so I think this one benefits from kind of a quick read through, like kind of dive right in and not stopping.
Yeah, I think I read it like that. So maybe I have different. It is a short time frame. I think a couple of them are. I think the one where they all go off to Wales and get shot only takes place over a couple of days. The odd one takes longer. I think despite its being a short time frame, it's a kind of slowish burn. I mean, it has this kind of explosive climax where there's a big fight at a nightclub and, you know, Shirley's throwing people through windows and so forth. But, you know, there is quite a lot of that. You know, you've got the retired spooks in the safe house trying to blackmail the service, and they're there for a bit. You've got River trying to find a missing library book from the old bastard's library, which of course is a safe secretly. And there's a certain amount of, you know, he talks to the librarian, he talks to the old colleague of the old bastard, you know, he shuffles around looking for this book. And there's, you know, again, the usual sort of very scorpion dancey conversations between Taverner and Jackson Lamb and Judd, where everyone's, you know, kind of maneuvering. So there's quite a lot of that, but I sort of feel like that's baked into the books a bit, that quite often they're quite talky.
Well, and I think the thing for me too is I didn't, especially in my first read, didn't really love the old spies. I don't know if Heron's been hanging around on book talks with Richard Osman a little too much and leaning into the old people kind of genre that is out there right now. But for me, they didn't quite work as well. And I mean, part of it is I think the stuff with the slow horses was really spot on this book. And so the stuff with them, I think, just didn't work quite as well. It wasn't as interesting.
Yeah, I love Roddy and his tattoo. The old spies, I mean, again, and I don't mean this as a sort of diss towards these books. They do have the quality that even sublimely good genre fiction has, which is you read them with absolute absorption and enjoyment, and then pressed on them 3 months later, there's a bunch of stuff you won't remember about. I mean, sometimes I'll start a new Slow Horses book and be like, oh, hang on, why is this character here or not here? What happened in the last book? I can't remember. That may just be me, but I think that is a quality slightly of these books. And certainly the retired spies, there's three of them, and there's one who's an older guy who's the sort of slightly King Lear-like figure who's, you know, bound to, it's all bound to end in tears and disappointment for him. But they aren't painted in the bright colours, and they aren't as memorable as Roddy and Shirley and the Slow Horses crew. But again, we've only had one book to be introduced to them. But yeah, they've faded a bit in my mind as characters. So I think, yeah, there's an aspect of that. But when you say, is he leaning into the Richard Osman thing? I don't think so much, in as much as all of these books, and I think it's what's one of the things very rich about them and a bit Le Carré-esque about them, is that they are very retrospective. When you think about how much of the action of these books is bound up with stuff that's buried 20, 30, 40 years ago, that, you know, really major figures like the old bastard, you know, David Cartwright, is the stuff he knows and has taken to his grave with him. It's always popping up out of the ground. Lerm's sweet spot is, in a sense, he's working out the aftermath of his years as a legend behind the Berlin Wall. Molly Doran, again, you know, we get in, I think it's called The Secret Hours, that novella, we get some of their backstory, but, you know, fundamentally, Molly and Lam are on their sort of victory lap. You know, they're in, you know, one step closer to being out to pasture. The slow horses themselves, the defining incidences in all of their lives, are in the past because those are the things that have put them in Slough House in the first place. And, you know, all that stuff, I mean, at least two books involve River's dad popping up out of the woodwork. And again, his heyday was back in the Cold War. So I sort of don't think they're, in some sense, I don't think they are contemporary spy novels. You know, I mean, Slough House is in some sense a kind of retirement home anyway.
That is true. I mean, and there is a lot of look back to the heyday of the Cold War and kind of the, you could say the great time of spying for Britain, right, was in the Cold War. And yeah, it does seem like there is a lot of that looking backwards.
And maybe that's part of it. I mean, I don't know how consciously, but perhaps it's like, okay, Le Carré's writing during the Cold War and his circus is a kind of serious place. And Mick Herron's writing after the end of the Cold War and his version of the circus is essentially a kind of comic place. I mean, it's a comic place with sadness, but there's a sort of corrosive sense of the fatuity and ridiculousness of Britain's place in the world, which is kind of reflected in the spies it gets in Slough House.
Well, and, you know, somebody, I'm not the one that came up with this concept, and it's not crazy revelation, but it does feel like Herron's spies are very Gen X spies. There's that kind of feeling of that era, that worldview is very much infused, I think, in his books here.
Yeah. No, they are. Yeah, there's that sort of slightly unserious, occasionally slightly self-entitled sort of slacker quality to them, you know.
So let's talk a little bit more, because for me, this book rests upon this one sequence in the nightclub where we get everybody kind of converging. And it's kind of what I think Herron does really well, is these switching between perspectives. And it feels so smooth. That sequence, it felt a lot longer, but it flew by. And I was just really impressed at how he's able to do that.
Well, I think that is, again, back to the he can effing write aspect of it. Like, he's really aware of point of view. You know, the only head you never go into is Jackson Lamb's, and I think that's an iron rule, and I think that's part of why, as I say, the nature of Lamb is the kind of central mystery around which the book kind of orbits from all these different angles. But he's just an incredibly good technician. I was talking to Philip Hencher on the Spectator's Book Club podcast a little while ago about our books of the last year, and Philip raised this one, and we both agreed it was terrific. And Philip said, you know, he doesn't get enough credit for this extraordinary use of free and direct style and his ability to kind of move from character to character and to give them each their own, not only voice in dialogue, but their own idiolect or voice in their internal monologues. And I mean, I remember, you know, reviewing two or three books ago, I remember clocking what seemed to me this absolutely virtuosic kind of brush pass in which he's following one character up the stairs. You know, because it's one of the three stories that, you know, Slough House has this flight of creaky stairs. And he's following a character up the stairs, and the character then hands the other one a sandwich. They've gone out for lunch. And with the sandwich, the narrative voice is transferred to the person who receives the sandwich. It's what, in spy terms, is a brush pass. And I was like, he's not making a big show of this. He's just, here's me being really technically virtuosic and clever and sort of funny, you know, there's no kind of enormous, laborious literary novel like that joke book in the Martin Amis's The Information, where it's got, you know, 14 different unreliable narrators. He's just doing it. He's amusing himself and he's getting done what needs to be done. And so that virtuosic ability to hop between perspectives is there. But of course, he's got this first person voice as well, omniscient narrator. You know, the omniscient narrator normally bookends it with this walking tour through or around Slough House. And that is extremely Dickensian and consciously so, I think.
Yeah.
And it will say these things. I mean, in this one, he's got a little disquisition on white noise and the meaning of white noise that again, is very much tell, don't show, two fingers up to that extremely hackneyed piece of advice, because he knows you're a good enough writer, you can get away with telling as much as you want.
Well, in this one, in that nightclub scene, he's passing between the folks, and we see Louisa in particular. He uses this, I don't know how you'd term it, affectation or whatever, of ellipses, right, between her perspective to distinguish her from everybody else. And that plays into the fact that we have these two folks, her and Ashley. Ashley gets shot, Louisa gets stabbed, and we're left for the rest of the book not knowing, because one of them has died and one of them has not. And he does some very tricky stuff to try and kind of keep audiences on edge. He doesn't even reveal it. I think, and that was one of the things, I mean, he is kind of going back to that well of, are they dead or are they not? Again, that he did with River. And so, I mean, I'm curious about what your thoughts about that was. Did you feel it was pretty definitive? Because I've seen, I thought it was pretty definitive from the little breadcrumbs that he left in there, who actually died. But do you have any perspective or thoughts on that?
Oh, I wish I'd read it recently enough to be sure. I sort of think Ash is dead, but I may be wrong. I mean, I think he's just leaving you guessing, and deliberately so, because, you know, that's what he does. He wants you to buy the next book.
Yeah, I mean, for me, when I looked at the evidence, I think there are a few things that are pretty distinctive in there that, you know, he talks about when whoever it is wakes up, he talks about them having a blunt hit and then a hole torn in them. And he kind of bounces, but the first word that they say when they wake up is mom. And we've had Ashley talking to her mom throughout.
Yeah.
But then Catherine has a letter that she's writing to the person who died's mother. So that he's kind of like kind of playing both sides to keep you on edge. But I think there's one line in there where River says, Ashley was shot and Louisa had her throat cut, that I don't think kind of jibes up with his discussion about a hole.
Oh, yeah, no. Well, that's, you're just being more attentive than me. I would think on balance, there's a sort of, you wonder whether it might be last in, first out, since he's killing off somebody who's been so important. You think, oh, he can't kill off two of the main slow horses at the same time. But actually, a throat cut would be that. But forgive me, I think my memory of the book is less fresh than yours, so.
No, which is fine. I think Ashley, as a character, has been not used very much.
No.
And I think Louisa, you feel like her story has kind of been told. And then you get metafictional, you know, the actor in the show that plays Louisa left this season. You know, is he kind of giving the TV show?
Oh, I'd be surprised. How far is the TV show catching up at this stage? I haven't been keeping tabs. I've been watching it, but I can't remember what book we're on.
So next season, last season was book 5. Next season, they're combining two books.
Okay.
So 6 and 7, which only leaves Bad Actors, which was the one before Clown Town. So they are catching up.
Well, I mean, they're still going to have a problem because they're going to have a Louisa for Bad Actors and Clown Town. So I don't think it can be a casting decision. And I wouldn't think he'd be led by the nose by the casting anyway. I mean, I know... he's as pleased as punch by the TV adaptations.
Sure.
You know, there's that story. Yeah. I think he still carries around in his pocket the business card for somebody's cover identity that he found in a closed drawer on the set. And he was just delighted by that. You know, that even the things that aren't on camera are properly worked out. So I think he loves the TV series. I think he's interested enough in doing what he does not to let the tail wag the dog that way. And to be honest, by this stage, I think he probably doesn't need to, in that they've just made Down Cemetery Road. You know, they're mining his back catalogue. You know, anything he does, they're going to be cool with. So, you know, I'm sure that his current success gives him a lot of what they call in the UK fuck off money. So he doesn't need to worry too much about all that. But I think more plausible is that he's gone,
you know, I've done with Louisa all I need to do, and I've introduced a new person, and let's give her a run. As he sort of did with JK. I sort of didn't think JK was going to survive as long as he did.
Yeah, well, and I think seeing Ashley come back after having this traumatic event would be interesting, I think. So that's my where my money is at, but we'll see.
Not that he's short on people coming back after having traumatic events. I mean, River and Sid are both now in a kind of post-traumatic.
Yes.
So, I mean, Shirley, of course, well, she's sort of traumatized everyone around her, but I think this one begins, doesn't it, with her having been released from the service hospital. Yes. Or mental institution or whatever it is, having kind of battered half the staff.
So let's talk about the other big revelation here, Peter Judd, because if we're looking for shocks in the book, I think that was one, because that was a big, big character to take out.
Well, that was huge. And that plays into my feeling that to really appreciate these books now, you need to be reading them in sequence, which is, that's like a huge, huge thing in this book. But it's not a huge thing if you've only read this book.
Yeah.
It's like the main payoff for the plot in this book would be the nightclub fight and the resolution of the pitchfork. But in a sense, for the series, the big deal in this book is the death of Peter Judd, because you are so not expecting it. And there's a lot of Lamb takes something out of his pocket, it's a cigarette. Lamb takes something out of his other pocket, it's a bottle of whiskey. Lamb takes something else, it's a handkerchief. Then Lamb takes a gun out of his pocket. And then you've got this whole, like, of course he's not going to shoot me. Oh, shit. And then he does. And that sort of, I think, in terms of the handling of that whole long sequence, how he gets there, the setup, how he's taken, the misdirection about what Judd expects. You know, because he's, again, using this mastery of tone of voice, that you're in Judd's head a lot in the run-up to that. And therefore, Judd's extraordinarily transactional worldview is one that you're invited to adopt as a narrative frame. So you're invited to think, Diana's not here. Jackson's going to negotiate with Judd directly. And all of this setup, the getting Roddy to put the cameras down, getting, you know, it's all designed for deniability. You can have this negotiation. And then he's misdirected you beautifully. And I think that's, in a way, it's that sequence really rather than the nightclub bit that stands out for me in the book. Because, I mean, even though it gives Roddy a bit of comic business with a tire iron to, you know, keep him busy while the main event's happening, you really are, right up to the end, invited, like Peter Judd, to think there's always another clever move to get out of this. And the fact that here's an example where suddenly you get a flicker of Lamb's absolutely deadly seriousness and his absolutely uncompromising, I don't know whether you call it morality or you call it something else, but that Lamb really strikes as an absolute viper. And we've had a version of this, as we'll know, that ran through the first several books, where it becomes clear that Charles' partner, who was Standish's old boss, that Lamb killed him because he was a traitor. And you don't learn that for quite a long time. But it's suddenly, when you do, it's like, oh, Christ. Actually, this guy has... He's not just a comic turn. He's not just a foul-mouthed Falstaff or a, you know, he really takes his job seriously. And he doesn't really subscribe to any of the conventional rules, but he subscribes to rules absolutely of his own, which is always attractive because you're trying to work out what those rules are. And like, I'm having a disagreement with the children's writer, Anthony McGowan, about Lee Child's novels, the Jack Reacher books. And he said, Christ, their apologies for fascism. Reacher is a law unto himself. And I'm like, well, you can argue that, you know, and it's all about force. And, like, you can argue that, but actually Reacher, like Jackson Lamb, is in a long tradition of kind of protagonists in a particular sort of fiction that runs right back to ancient tales of the Knight Errant, to the Wandering Samurai, in which there's a character who is outside society and obeys no laws, but has an absolutely kind of rigid set of internalized rules. I mean, with Reacher, there's a spin-off book produced called Reacher's Rules, which is about his rules for living. And in a sense, that's an apology for vigilantism or fascism or lack of accountability. But, you know, I would write in the proviso, this stuff's fiction. It's a fantasy. And in real life, as everybody from Alan Moore to writing Watchmen or the, you know, Mark Miller's Civil War timeline in the Marvel superhero comics has pointed out, the fantasy of Superman kind of is a fascist fantasy. It's slightly terrifying, the idea that there's an extraordinarily powerful person who's a goody
but they're a goody who operates outside any form of constraint, oversight, or legal framework. It's an anti-democratic fantasy, and obviously these people happen to be goodies, thank goodness, but in real life, people like that would be effing terrifying. You know, and they do exist, and they're people like Steak Knife.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is interesting. You know, there is a desire for somebody who can bring order to chaos, right? And, you know, and so I think that's what some of these types of series do, right? You want to see that person who can has that moral character that will guide them no matter what, and they don't waver at all. Because all of us are hypocrites to a certain extent, I would say.
We're all hypocrites, and we all generally, I mean, you know, is sometimes said, you know, this is a kind of broadening it out, but, you know, there's a good saying about democracy that it's valuable, you know, democracy and the rule of law are valuable for what they prevent rather than for what they enable. And we are impatient because they are constraints.
Yeah.
And, you know, wouldn't it be great if instead of, you know, filing a police report and then doing nothing about it, and Lee Child has been very open about this with Reacher, he said, you know, someone steals your car, wouldn't it be great if you were 8 foot tall and could go and pound their face into corned beef rather than filing a police report and waiting 3 weeks to get a letter referring you to victim support? We all fantasize about ignoring these constraints. We fantasize about an absolute assurance that we could do violence in the cause of right. I mean, Lamb's a bit more complicated than that, I think, because he sort of is interested in structures and he's interested in the geopolitical setup. He's not just about smashing people in the face, but he is sort of equally a figure who operates somewhat outside the ordinary constraints, but according to a very rigid internal morality.
We talked about how most of the time the characters end up kind of back where they're at, but I did find it interesting in this book. We do see some glimmers of character movement. You know, Catherine changes. She's the one that's kind of pushing people out there to make some changes, whereas Lamb is the one that's saying that they should just stay back and be protected, which is a fun reversal. We've got Roddy, who at the very end kind of has this little glimmer of understanding of the reality of what's going on. Everybody is damaged by these, the person that's dying, the person that's in the hospital. How important do you think it is to see those kind of things in a series novel? Do we have to see them change in some incremental ways?
Well, I think it's always a choice of the author. You know, I mean, lots of the most long-running kind of series, like, you find your Poirot, your Maigret, or whatever, and those characters don't age. They don't develop in a substantial way. And they, you know, I think Heron is in a slightly different game. I think he's such a clever writer, he almost completely gets around it. But my sense of the sort of limitations of the formula are that he's simultaneously trying to insist that Lamb is a comic figure and that he's dangerous. He's simultaneously insisting that sort of deaths. There's a kind of very slight grinding of gears in that he doesn't want you, I think, to... He wants these deaths and, you know, the damage to have some weight. But he also kind of wants the comic tone of the novels to be preserved. And I think that can be tricky, because if the characters all go into mourning or are traumatized, you're in a different set of novels. And he sort of gets away with it, but it's a very delicate kind of handkerchief dance.
Yeah.
Whereby, you know, you kind of do feel, I think, something for instance, the death of the OB in River's relationship with the OB and the loss of Min that Louise is mourning for the last few books. You know, that does have some weight and gravity to it. But equally, they're all supposed to be essentially utterly miserable, longing to escape from Slough House. And some of them are sort of trying to. But that's also presented as a kind of comic dilemma.
Yeah.
They're miserable, but they're also kind of having a laugh in the office. And being in Slough House, you know, if they were all genuinely kind of suicidal, a lot of the fun would drain out of the novel. You know, it has to be a bit like they're all prepared to be addressed in a great comic scene in which Lamb dresses them all down as an absolutely useless bunch, invites them to quit, and they kind of refuse, or they go, you know, I mean, there is a tonal difficulty. As I say, he kind of does an incredibly good job of resolving. And I think in other hands, he'd either end up making it a bit mawkish or making it so comical that the deaths and the character developments would feel essentially weightless.
Yeah, I mean, he does such a good job of making these characters feel real, even though they are so absurd to a certain extent. Part of it is, you know, being able to see your own absurdity reflected back in some of the characters, I think, is something that he does very well. I mean, I think that's part of the reason that, you know, I look, and the listenership of this podcast is basically evenly divided between men and women, which for basically any other espionage series is not something that's going to happen. And so I think part of that comes down to the way that he not only does his female characters, but just does the characters in general.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there's a lot, there is a lot going on. And that comedy tragedy thing, the difference between comedy and tragedy often is one of perspective. And this is a book, a series of books that has multiple perspectives. I mean, I thought Mel Brooks put it very well when he said, you know, tragedy is when I cut my finger, comedy is when you fall into an open sewer and die. And that's going on here a bit. But I think the character work is sort of serious. I mean, Standish, I think he treats Standish's addiction very well and sometimes even nudges towards being moving on the subject. I think there is some sort of real tenderness in the relationship between Lamb and Molly Doran, which he fleshes in The Secret Hours a bit. There's tenderness in the relationship between River and his grandfather. The Min Louisa thing is real. I don't know whether you ever quite feel sorry for Roddy. He's almost always played for laughs. But sort of Shirley's anger isn't always just a sort of comic, oh, Shirley's going to put someone's head through a door thing. And I think he does manage to put some proper emotional heft into it. And again, you know, I referred earlier to The Office. I think one of the things that really added depth to that very, very funny show. I mean, I think I'm talking about the UK version, which I've seen more than the US version, which had a more closed arc. I think the US version's an open-ended thing and is going on forever and, you know, depositing a few $100,000 in Ricky Gervais's bank account every few weeks. But the British one, the relationship between Tim and Dawn, there was some real kind of excitement and romance in that. And there is a sort of real poignancy to the figure of David Brent, the sort of, for all of his awfulness, you can kind of see he is this kind of quite sad figure lacking self-knowledge. And when they close the branch and, you know, everyone's reassigned to wherever it is, Stakey Pages or Milton Keynes or whatever, there's a kind of mourning to it. So I think the same strange alchemy is performed here.
Yeah. So, you know, next book certainly has some interesting threads to pull. You know, there's these two cameras that weren't shut down, River's status with the park. Diana's not in charge. We don't have Taverner. That's crazy. Judd is dead. You know, we also don't know who was killed. So next book, I feel like he's got some stuff to pull on. But Hearn's also said he knows how he'd like to end it. You know, do you see a long run to the rest of the series, or do you think he'll end it soon, or is he going to have that final book in the drawer, you know, like Perot waiting?
Do you know, I have no idea. I mean, I hadn't known he had an ending in mind, and I think it's to his great credit if he does. And I always thought this is one of the things J.K. Rowling should get credit for Harry Potter. She could have made that an open-ended series that went on forever, and she'd have been even more galactically rich than she is. But actually, she told one story and she stopped. I mean, certainly it would be structurally and generically possible for Slough House as a series of novels to go on forever. And I kind of half expected them to. But I think maybe Nick will have thought, I don't want it to become a formula that becomes exhausted. To me, the books are still good. I don't think the formula's running out of steam. I've seen some people saying that they do, that they think, oh God, I've seen this Jackson Lamb routine before. I think they're still good. But I think if he's thinking, I can't do this forever at the same level, he could probably do this forever at the same level of success. But he's going like, I don't need to be greedy about it. I'd rather do something more artistically satisfying. And I think that would be great, which goes back to our previous discussion about how they're not quite standalones. The fact they're not quite standalones means that they maybe aren't completely a home on fleuve. Maybe they are. There's the book-length arcs, the two or three book-length arcs, and maybe there is one gigantic arc that we're only just seeing emerge. I mean, I certainly hope that he doesn't stop it with the next book.
I don't think that's the case, but it did sound, it was interesting to hear him say that he has kind of now come up with an idea of how he might like to see the series end up. And so I thought that was interesting.
Well, what would you do next? Back to Zoe Boehm.
I guess, right? I think his next book is not related to Slough House. So it's a standalone or some sort of other thing is what's been put out there. So we'll see.
Well, I mean, as you say, you know, he started as a poet. He can do anything.
So you're a gamer, a video gamer.
I am, yes.
You know, we've got a TV series of The Slow Horses. Could you see, you want to see a Slough House video game? Could you see that out there?
Oh, my God. That is a question I had not even considered. I think it would be quite a challenge to devise one. I mean, in a way, I think certainly wouldn't be a first-person shooter. That would remove all of the pleasure out of it. I mean, the thing is, the Slough House books are very talky. They're very about motives and people working angles and things like that. So, you know, an old school text-based adventure I would welcome, but I think that's probably the best analog to it you get.
Yes, I can see you get to choose the comebacks to Jackson Lamb and see which one gets you through.
Exactly, or one of those sort of point and click detective stories.
Yeah. Well, Sam, thank you so much for talking through Clown Town. I've really appreciated it.
It's been my pleasure, Jeff. Thank you.
If folks want to keep up with your work, what's the best way to do that?
Well, I don't have a website like a slacker, but I work for The Spectator magazine, which is where a lot of my stuff is to be found, and otherwise my new book is published by One World, and my previous books, most of them published by Profile. So, you know, just Google me.
All right. Well, that's going to wrap things up for this epic season of Barbican Station. Thanks so much to everybody who listened for the past few months. Like a good sleeper agent, we're going into hibernation, but the show will return to talk through the next season of Slow Horses. Plus, we'll likely have another book discussion on the third Zoe Boehm novel. In the meantime, make sure you're subscribed so you see when the show returns, leave a review, and drop me a note. You can find me at lacarecast@gmail.com. Until next time, thanks for listening. What you're listening to? There's more like it. Exploring the works of John le Carré, each episode of the Le Carré Cast looks at a specific novel or an unexplored aspect of his life and work. Join us as we take a deep dive into the world of espionage John le Carré has revealed. Search for Le Carré Cast wherever you listen to podcasts or at lecarrecast.com. Spybrary's Spy Rewind uses one episode of a classic spy TV show, like Mission Impossible, Alias, or Get Smart, to talk about the show as a whole. It's at spybrary.com or search for Spybrary in your podcast app. Like the Wolf is a podcast dedicated to the Nero Wolfe mystery series created by Rex Stout. The podcast has reviews of all of his stories, plus interviews with a wide variety of Wolf fans. Find it in your podcatcher under Like the Wolf or at likethewolf.com. That's Wolf with an E. They're all novel podcasts, and you can find them all if you type novel.network in your browser. That's novel.network.